Hello, everybody. Today we are going to be sad. As I've mentioned before, I'm currently working my way through Junji Ito's works, and I just finished his story, No Longer Human. And Ito himself is a master of horror, coming up with some of the most bizarre concepts and images that I've ever seen put to paper. So going into this story, I figured it would be scary, but after reading so many of his other stories and, you know, making the videos that I make, I figured that I'd be tough enough to handle it. And I was not tough enough to handle it. This story has affected me in a way few others managed to do. So midway through reading it, I thought I would do some research on the story itself, because this is an adaptation of a pre-existing novel that I didn't know about before I started this. So I decided to research the original story of No Longer Human and its author, Osamu Dazai, to hopefully feel better about myself. And that is the opposite of what happened. No Longer Human is one of the most brutal, depressing, and heartbreaking stories that I've ever read. Not only that, but its adaptation by Junji Ito is perhaps the most shocking and profound adaptation I have ever seen. And perhaps the best way I can explain that is by taking you on the same journey I went on while reading these two books. Before we begin, I believe this story to be incredibly impactful and important to share, which is why I'm doing that now, but you have to be in the right headspace to take this story as a benefit to yourself, because it is very easy for the elements of this story to be a detriment, and I do not want that to happen. So, a content warning, and I mean it, if you have any issues when it comes to violence, violence against women, or violence against oneself, then probably sit out this video. Not only does the story deal with these subjects, but as we're going to talk about, several of these themes relate back to real life events. So rather than adding a bunch of in Minecrafts and allegedlies and disconnect from server or whatever to talk about actual tragedies that happen to real people, I'm going to discuss them honestly. And if YouTube would rather me make fun of the depression and misery of real world people, then they can take it up with God. I'm not gonna do it. And if you're still watching, then stick around as we get sad. But do you know what isn't sad? That's right, saving money. And you can start saving money now thanks to today's sponsor, PayPal Honey. Honey is the number one shopping tool in America that helps you save money whenever you shop online. You can get Honey in just two easy clicks, and then after that, anytime you're at checkout, Honey will search the web to try to find you the best coupon codes available. Honey can save you money on things that you're already paying for. For example, got a scary book or movie that you want to check out for Halloween? Order it with Honey on your browser and see if you can't get a better deal. So if it's food, clothes, electronics, or anything in between, Honey has you covered. And that's because thanks to Honey, saving money is as easy as lifting a finger. And it's thanks to Honey that you can start finding deals for free by going to the link in the description at joinhoney.com/Wendigoon. And then whenever you're at checkout, just let Honey do its thing and start saving money for free. Again, that's joinhoney.com/Wendigoon. Get in today. Thank you all so much for watching the ad. Thank you so much to Honey for sponsoring the video. It really does mean the most. Hope you all check them out. Link is in the description, and we are back to the video. We are going to go ahead and get into it, but as always, thank you for watching. The 1948 novel, No Longer Human, opens with no explanation of who's speaking or who is being spoken about. The prologue simply opens with the sentence, "I have seen three pictures of the man." From there, the author begins to describe images taken of some man at three different points in his life. The first being of the man when he was a young boy, the second being him when he was in either high school or college, and the third being at an undetermined time in the future when gray hair has begun to take him over. Through the description of each picture, the author says that there's something uncanny and twisted about the man. While the images initially seem to be normal, it is the expression of the boy's face that drives the author mad. The author says that whatever this person is, he's far removed from humanity. His smile and expressions are just a mask concealing something much darker beneath the surface. The prologue is simply a discussion of these three photographs, and after remarking time and time again that this person couldn't be human, the prologue ends on this note. "I think that even a death mask would hold more of an expression, leave more of a memory. That effigy suggests nothing so much as a human body to which a horse's head has been attached. Something ineffable makes the beholder shudder in distaste. I have never seen such an inscrutable face on a man." And from there, our story begins with Notebook 1. The story we're now reading is divided into three notebooks, and as we'll find out at the end, these three notebooks are of the boy who was pictured in the three photographs. And to emphasize that, the first notebook opens with the lines, "Mine has been a life of much shame. I can't even guess myself what it must be to live the life of a human being." This person writing the story is a boy named Yozo, or at least the man named Yozo writing about his time as a child. As the opening line said, Yozo doesn't associate himself with humanity, and this is something that began for Yozo at a very young age. For instance, Yozo says that when he was a kid, all the adults would tell him that he needs to eat or else he'll get weak or eventually die. But Yozo says that he's never experienced hunger. In fact, he considers it bizarre that most people feel like they need to eat food, when to him it's completely pointless. As a matter of fact, Yozo considers a lot of things humanity does to be either very boring or very terrifying. He considers things like emotion and desire to be scary, as he's never experienced those. But at the same time, he considers humanity dull and boring because everything they do serves some greater purpose. For instance, Yozo says that when he was a child, he was at a train station and saw a bridge that connected two platforms. Yozo thought that the bridge was interesting and pleasant because it was just a weird structure. But whenever he found out that it actually serves a purpose, walking from one platform to the other, he lost interest because he says everything humanity does is just to serve their greater needs. They don't just do things in order to do them like Yozo does. He says the same thing about pillowcases. He thought that pillowcases were just an interesting thing that you put on a pillow for no greater reason. But whenever he found out the purpose is to clean them so that you don't get the pillow dirty, he lost interest. Yozo has a very unique and almost alien outlook on life, and that's something we're going to see more of as the story progresses. Yozo was born into a very rich family, and while he doesn't have a lot of memories of his mother, his father was a distinguished politician. Because of that, Yozo grew up in a very large house in the countryside along with his brothers and sisters, as well as a large waitstaff. The first true example of how detached Yozo is from the reality of people, and again, I stress content warning, is when Yozo says that as a child, the family waitstaff, both men and women, would repeatedly abuse him in every sense of the word. And Yozo thought this was odd, not because of the brutality and horror of it, but because it was so weird to him that people would continue to chase emotions and desire like that. He says that he was corrupted by them, and while that undoubtedly had an effect on his soul, during these moments he would just sit there and stare at them, unable to comprehend why a person would have the need to do anything. It's from this that Yozo begins to become terrified of the concept of people. Because while Yozo himself doesn't care for things like emotion and desire, he finds it terrifying that any person could do whatever they want in order to get their desire at any given moment. And that eventually forms into a fear of connection, as Yozo is terrified by the thought of people understanding him and relating to him on any personal level. So in order to stave off the possibility of someone coming close to him, Yozo begins what he calls clowning. Yozo realizes that if he makes jokes and can make people laugh, that he can wear a sort of mask, and then because of that, people won't think to get any closer. They'll think that he's just a clown, and that's all there is. So Yozo gets into a cycle of constantly putting on a performance to make other people laugh so that they never ask any further questions. And during this time in his life, anytime someone suggests anything to him, he immediately goes along with it. Since humanity and emotions is a foreign concept to him, he doesn't know what he would do if someone didn't get what they wanted, or if emotions had to come out in any sense that wasn't a blanket positivity. An example of this that Yozo remembers far into adulthood when he writes these notebooks is one day when Yozo was a kid, his father was about to journey to Tokyo and asked all of his kids what they would like from the toy shop. After all of his brothers and sisters are done telling their dad what toy they want, the dad eventually comes to Yozo. Yozo says that there isn't anything he wants because he doesn't desire or want for anything. He's never experienced happiness. So when his father asks what would he like from the toy store, Yozo freezes. Eventually, his father suggests, "What if I got you a tiger mask?" And Yozo again freezes. Eventually, one of his brothers says that the father should just get Yozo a book. And his father seems disappointed by this, and it begins to bother Yozo so much that that night he sneaks into his father's office and writes Tiger Mask in his notebook so that his father will think that Yozo wanted a tiger mask so bad that he snuck into his office to write it in a notebook, and sure enough, that's what happens. So whenever his father returns with the tiger mask, he's excited to think that he got something for his son that his son would enjoy, when in actuality, Yozo just did it because he's terrified of the concept of letting anyone down. Not because he cares for them, but he's terrified of what would happen if someone didn't get their way. Yozo continues this act of clowning throughout his younger years, and eventually into high school. Because of this, he never makes any genuine connections. He's just the constant joke of the class, who makes a fool of himself in front of the students and teachers. But this is exactly what Yozo wants. That is, until one day, when a student named Takaichi calls him out. Yozo describes Takaichi as being a simpleton, someone who Yozo didn't think had any higher order function of thinking at all until he stops Yozo in his tracks. One day Yozo is outside during PE and he jokingly misses the bar at a jump, falls on the ground, and everyone laughs. But then Takaichi, the otherwise quiet kid, comes up and pokes Yozo on the back before saying in his ear, "You did that on purpose." Upon hearing this, a fear rips through Yozo, one of the strongest emotions he's ever felt. See, Yozo's greatest fear is other people getting close to him, or anyone seeing him for what he really is. And for the first time, Takaichi has done that. So Yozo is determined to either A, make Takaichi a friend so that he never tells anyone, or pray that he dies. And surprisingly, the former happens. Yozo and Takaichi begin to grow close, or at least as close as someone who is just friends with you because it's either that or they kill you. Takaichi is very kind to Yozo, even remarking one day that women will surely go crazy over him, which, if you know where this story goes, is ironically tragic. That leads into another detail of this story that comes up throughout the narrative. Yozo is described as being incredibly attractive, so much so that women are always at least semi-interested in him, if not throwing themselves onto him. But for Yozo, who hates the idea of human connection or getting close to anyone, this is more of a curse than a blessing. When contemplating the idea of women falling for him, Yozo says, "Women led me on only to throw me aside. They mocked and tortured me when others were around, only to embrace me with passion as soon as everyone had left. Women sleep so soundly they seem to be dead. Who knows? Women may live in order to sleep." These and various other generalizations were products of an observation of women since boyhood days. But my conclusion was that though women appear to belong to the same species as man, they are actually quite different creatures. And these incomprehensible, insidious beings have, fantastic as it seems, always looked after me. In my case, such an expression as to be fallen for, or even to be loved, is not in the least appropriate. Perhaps it describes the situation more accurately to say that I was looked after. Women will become a primary part of Yozo's life as the story goes on, but as we can see from his mention of it now, this is not something that he enjoys. This too began at a young age. During this portion of the story, whenever Yozo is attending high school, he is living with two of his far-related cousins. These cousins, who are both girls around Yozo's age, think he's hilarious and spend all of their time trying to get him to tell funny stories or act in this funny character that he puts on in front of them. He watches as these cousins invite their friends over, only to talk behind their backs as soon as they leave, which, again, for Yozo, who is already afraid of interhuman emotion and desire, this terrifies him because he realizes how easy it is for someone to put on a face. As a matter of fact, these cousins become so enamored with him that one night the older of the two run into Yozo's room and ask that they run away together. It's also around this time that Takaichi says something to Yozo that gives Yozo hope for the rest of his life to come. One day, Takaichi shows Yozo the famous self-portrait of Vincent van Gogh. And upon showing it to Yozo, he says, "This is a picture of a ghost." Yozo's taken back by this, so he gets a series of paintings by Modigliani and shows those to Takaichi. Takaichi says that these pictures look terrific, and as a matter of fact, points to one of them and says that it looks like a horse out of hell. Yozo thinks on this for a moment, and then comes to a realization. There are some people whose dread of human beings is so morbid that they reach a point where they yearn to see with their own eyes monsters of ever more horrible shapes. And the more nervous they are, the quicker to take fright, the more violent they pray that every storm will be. Painters who have had this mentality, after repeated wounds and intimidations at the hands of the apparitions called human beings, have often come to believe in phantasms. They plainly saw monsters in broad daylight, in the midst of nature. And they did not fob people off with clowning. They did their best to depict these monsters just as they had appeared. Takaichi was right. They had dared to paint pictures of devils. These, I thought, would be my friends in the future. I was so excited I could have wept. I'm going to paint too. I'm going to paint pictures of ghosts and devils and horses out of hell. See, that same mindset that Yozo had as a child, when he would see bridges and pillowcases, and think of how beautiful it is that humanity can create something that it doesn't necessarily need, that applies to art. And while before he thought that art was just a way to express how beautiful the world is, he now realizes that it can also express how terrible it is. So for the first time in his life, he has hope, he has happiness. And that happiness is to make others see the monsters that he sees every day. After high school, Yozo wants to attend an art school, but his father urges and eventually makes him go to a normal college. However, while he's at college, he begins to skip his classes frequently and attend art classes to the side. And his real troubles begin when he meets a friend by the name of Hariki. Hariki initially asked Yozo for money, and after Yozo gave it to him, Hariki invited Yozo to come drinking. Yozo had never drank before, but as he began to get hammered, he realized that the overbearing fear of humanity that always plagued his life began to fade away. Because of this, Yozo stops caring about pursuing a career in art, and instead just cares about numbing his feelings. So, he gets into a cycle of skipping classes and using his father's monthly allowance to get drunk with Hariki. It's a little too assuming to call Yozo and Hariki a friendship. Yozo even makes note of this, because what it really is Hariki likes to command conversations and hear himself talk, and Yozo likes that he doesn't have to talk whenever Hariki's around, and they both just like to get drunk. So that's the start and end of their relationship. It's not long into this friendship that Hariki introduces Yozo to his second favorite pastime, prostitution. Initially, Yozo loves this idea. He says that while he's admired the female form, he has despised the concept of getting close with one. So here, he can do the first part without having to do the second part. He remarks that he doesn't think of them as people, which normally would be a horrific insult, but here is a compliment, because he doesn't fear them in the same way that he fears most people, because he feels that the transaction is purely professional. However, if you'll remember as mentioned earlier in the story, not only is Yozo a beautiful man, but as he said, he feels that women are attracted to his loneliness, and as he begins to see these same workers time and time again, they begin to be attracted back to him. So Yozo quits seeing them as he fears developing any kind of a connection. A lot of the elements of this story are kind of timeless. Like, while yes, the literal narrative is from 1920s into 1930s Japan, a lot of the ideas and interactions are relevant to any time period. And it's because of that that the following story element is the only thing that really dates it or constrains it to a point in history. After several months of Yozo and Hariki going on their drunken escapades together, Hariki introduces Yozo to his now third pastime, the Communist Party. At this point in Japanese history, imperialism was on the rise, and Japan itself was becoming much more militaristic. Because of that, rivaling political parties like communism were seen as illegal, and if anyone was caught in league with the communist or the reds, they were thrown in prison until they retracted their beliefs. So Hariki asked Yozo to begin joining him during these underground meetings. Yozo begins to attend these meetings and says he thinks they're all really stupid, and as a matter of fact, it's stupid for people to care about anything really, but especially politics and money stuff. However, despite his complete lack of care for anything the communists believe in, he thinks that it is very interesting to do something you're not supposed to. So Yozo begins to attend these meetings religiously just because he likes the idea of doing something that is outside of society's accepted parameters. He also remarks how he thinks it's dumb that everyone is so serious, you know, in these underground political meetings. And if you'll remember that mention earlier, like with the whole tiger mask his dad wanted to get him thing, Yozo can't tell people no because he's afraid of people not getting their way. So every time the Communist Party asks him to do something, he just does it right away. And because of that, he quickly ascends the ranks as one of the leaders of the underground communist faction in Japan. And keep in mind, he does not care for communism at all. It's also around this time that he just starts running errands for the Communist Party and totally quits school altogether. So since his grades begin failing, his father pulls his monthly allowance. So at this point, he is in debt, out of school, an alcoholic, and the leader of an underground communist rebellion. So, I'm sure his dad's glad he didn't go to art school. It's really one of the two career options for failed artists in the 1930s. You either become an alcoholic or Hitler. One night while Yozo is broke and drunk in the street, he stumbles into a restaurant. At the restaurant, he explains to the waitress that he has no money, but just wants to drink. The waitress, surprisingly, says that it's on the house and lets him. As a matter of fact, she lets him drink himself into a stupor as she caringly sits beside and watches over him. As a matter of fact, when Yozo becomes too drunk to return home, she takes him back to her house. Tsuneko is incredibly depressed, and she explains to Yozo that her husband has been locked away for several years, and she has no purpose in life. Yozo, for the first time in his life, feels comfort in this woman's presence. Because for the first time, he found someone who is potentially as miserable as he is. So as the two exist together that night, he feels, for the first time, unalone in the world. However, the next day, once he's sobered up, he becomes afraid of human connection, turns on the clown attitude, and leaves her house. A few nights later, Yozo and Hariki are out drinking, and Hariki decides to go to the same restaurant that Tsuneko works at. On the way in, Hariki announces that he's so hungry for a woman that whichever woman serves them, he's gonna kiss. And sure enough, the woman that serves them is Tsuneko. So Hariki goes to kiss Tsuneko, but just before he does, he stops himself and says he can never kiss a woman so poor and destitute. And while Yozo feels bad that his friend would say something so cruel, it almost draws him closer to Tsuneko. So that night, Yozo once again stays with Tsuneko. And while laying in bed, Tsuneko says that she wants to die. And Yozo says that they should do it. The two venture off to the coast together and make plans to jump into the ocean. On the way there, the weight of doing this didn't really hit Yozo until they went to pay for food and all he had left to his name was 3 coins. And from that, he decides, oh, well, I can't continue to live like this, so it's a good thing we're doing what we're about to do. And after this, the story simply reads, "We threw ourselves into the sea at Kamakura that night. She untied her sash, saying she had borrowed it from a friend at the cafe, and left it folded neatly on a rock. I removed my coat and put it in the same spot. We entered the water together. She died. I was saved." Because Yozo was the son of a prominent politician, this story was featured heavily in the newspapers around Japan. Yozo was arrested and being held on charges of assisting with Tsuneko's death. And it's because of this that Yozo's father completely cut him off. One day while being interrogated by the police, Yozo had slightly cut himself, and there was a little bit of blood on a napkin that he later coughed into. The interrogating officer saw the blood on the napkin when he coughed and asked Yozo if he's coughing up blood. Yozo, not in an effort to get away with it, but just because, again, he's so afraid of not telling people what they want to hear, just said yes and began hamming up his cough. It's partially because of this Yozo believes that the police let him off easy as they figured he was sick and nearly dead from the incident anyhow. So with everyone Yozo encounters while he's under arrest, he keeps doing this fake cough. Until eventually, while he's talking to the DA, he does the fake cough, and the DA asks, "Was that real?" And immediately, Yozo is transported back to the boy who was afraid when Takaichi said that he did it on purpose. As a matter of fact, Yozo says that he would have rather spent 10 years in jail than to live through that moment when the DA saw through his mask. Yozo is eventually discharged to a man named Flatfish, or at least Yozo's family called the man Flatfish. Flatfish was a friend of Yozo's family, So, Yozo's father began to give Yozo money through Flatfish. That way, officially, it still seems that he excommunicated his son. For a while, Yozo is essentially kept prisoner by Flatfish, as Flatfish doesn't allow him to leave the house or do much of anything. Until one day, Flatfish just asks Yozo what Yozo wants to do with his life. And when Yozo responds that he wants to be a painter because there's still a little bit of that optimism left in him, Flatfish laughs and tells him to think it over and find a real career. So that night, Yozo sneaks out of the house and goes to see Hariki. Hariki does not want to see Yozo because now Yozo has a stigma attached to him. If you'll remember, Hariki and Yozo met at an art class, and as Yozo comes in, Hariki tells him to leave because he's trying to finish up a manga that he's working on for a local newspaper. As they're talking, someone from the newspaper comes in, a woman by the name of Shizuko. As Yozo leaves, Shizuko leaves with him and the two begin to talk. And as they're talking, once again, a woman falls for Yozo's whole sad e-boy thing, and Shizuko invites Yozo to come live with her and her daughter. And then while staying with Shizuko, Yozo doesn't necessarily get happy, but he gets kind of comfortable. Like, he enjoys that he has, you know, a roof to live under, but he also enjoys the company of Shizuko's daughter, as he feels that children don't have all of the weird malice and intricacies of an adult, so this is someone that he can maybe talk to and be honest with. And while Shizuko herself is kind to Yozo, she's not overbearing or tries to get too close. And eventually, Yozo begins drawing mangas for her newspaper. What kind of encapsulates this span of time for Yozo is while he's staying in Shizuko's apartment, he looks outside and on the telephone wire is a kite that once flew through the air but is now stuck to the wire, neither in flight or on the ground. And he says during this time in his life, he feels like that kite. He's being held up, he's not doing good, but he's also not doing bad. And he mentions that from this manga work, he's made enough money to begin to afford his own alcohol and cigarettes, which are the only things he really cares about. One day while talking to Hariki, or more specifically being present while Hariki's talking, Hariki says that Yozo should just go ahead and marry this woman because society won't accept a man who lives unmarried with an unmarried woman. And this begins to spur questions in Yozo. What is society? Society is Hariki, right? When Hariki says society won't accept it, he's just saying that Hariki won't accept it. From there, Yozo begins to think to himself and philosophize that perhaps society is just a sum of individuals acting for themselves. And because of that, it is both more understandable, because to understand the person is to understand society, and hopelessly more terrifying, because Yozo cannot hope to understand a person. A lot of these inner thoughts of Yozo don't matter now, but whenever we talk about the greater meaning of this story at the end, you'll see why these are much more brutal. Nevertheless, Yozo is thinking about marrying Shizuko, not because he loves her, but just because this seems to be a okay state of being. Until one day, when Yozo is in the apartment with Shizuko's daughter, and the daughter asks him if he believes in prayer and believes in talking to God. Yozo says that he doesn't think that he deserves a prayer to God, but asks the daughter what she would pray for. And the daughter says that she would pray to have her real dad back. And upon hearing that, Yozo says, "I felt dizzy with the shock. An enemy. Was I Shigeko's enemy, or was she mine? Here was another frightening grown-up who would intimidate me. A stranger, an incomprehensible stranger, a stranger full of secrets." Shigeko's face suddenly began to look that way. I had been deluding myself with the belief that Shigeko at least was safe. But she too was like the ox which suddenly lashes out with its tail to kill the horsefly on its flank. I knew that from then on, I would have to be timid even before that little girl. From there, Yozo continues to put his walls up. Not only is he not nice to Shigeko, Shizuko's daughter, but he's also mean to Shizuko as well. He begins to insult her, saying that whenever she sleeps, she looks like an old man, and he gets the ugly characters from his comics just by looking at her. He also continues to drink more and more, and whenever he runs out of money, he takes Shizuko's clothes and pawns them at a pawn shop so that he can have more money to go drinking. One day he comes home after staying out late, and hears Shizuko and Shigeko talking behind the door. He hears Shigeko asking why Yozo, who Shigeko now calls Daddy, is always out drinking so much. He hears her mother play it down, and then watches as her mother gets out a pet bunny that she got for her daughter. And it's then that Yozo has a moment of clarity that these two are happy together, and Yozo might ruin that. So without saying goodbye or a further word to them, he turns and never comes back. Eventually, he stumbles into a bar that he regularly visits and tells the bartender that he needs somewhere to stay. So the bartender, a woman who is, again, attracted to Yozo, says that he can stay in the apartment above the bar. Across the street from the bar is a cigarette stand, where he also frequents once he has become drunk enough to stand talking to other people. And it's here that he meets the person selling the cigarettes, a 17-year-old girl named Yoshiko. Yoshiko is also enamored by Yozo's beauty, but unlike other older women, she's too young to recognize the danger that he holds. Yoshiko is fairly trusting, so whenever a drunk Yozo comes to her and begins putting on this act of being a comedian, she just thinks that he is a very charming and loving man. After several months of this, one day while walking across the street, Yozo falls into a manhole. Yoshiko runs to help him, and while patching him up, says that he shouldn't drink anymore. And Yozo says that she's right, and he's giving up drinking forever. And as a matter of fact, he says, "If I'm gonna quit drinking, why don't you marry me?" He says this as a half joke, but Yoshiko, who's far too trusting, says that she'd love to. And the two make a promise that if Yozo doesn't drink anymore, that they'll be married. So the next day, Yozo gets drunk again, as you could imagine, and he comes across the street to tell Yoshiko that the deal's off because he broke the promise. Yoshiko says that he's just lying to get out of it, because there's no way that someone would break a promise they just made. So Yozo, who is, let's be honest, good for nothing, essentially. I mean, you live with a woman and start stealing her clothes to buy alcohol, not really a man of virtue. Yozo sees this young girl who is so enamored with him and so trusting that she literally does not believe that he could break a pinky promise he made the day before. And whenever she says she still wants to marry him, what's Yozo's reaction? Yoshiko's pale face was smiling as she sat there inside the dimly lit shop. "What a holy thing uncorrupted virginity is," I thought. I had never slept with a virgin, a girl younger than myself. I'd marry her. I wanted once in my lifetime to know that great savage joy, no matter how immense the suffering that might ensue. So, call him what you want, but you have to call him consistent. And when remarking on the marriage itself, he says, "Not long afterwards, we were married. The joy I obtained as a result of this action was not necessarily great or savage, but the suffering which ensued was staggering, so far surpassing what I had imagined that even describing it as horrendous would not quite cover it." So the two become married, and for some time things are okay in the same way they were when he was with Shizuko. He's not necessarily in love with her or happy, but he's just kind of existing. He does remark that while not in a sense of love or romance, he develops an appreciation for Yoshiko because of how different from him she is. Because Yozo is fully distrusting and afraid of humanity at every circumstance. Meanwhile, Yoshiko is super trusting of everyone and loves everybody as a friend. So Yozo admires her more so as something that he cannot be. As a matter of fact, Yoshiko's so trusting that whenever Hariki comes by and loudly announces things like, "Hey, that woman you lived with for a while with, you know, just her and her daughter, she says that she wants you to come see her sometime," and Yoshiko thinks nothing of it. One night, Hariki comes over, and Yozo and Hariki go to the roof of their apartment to get drunk and discuss concepts of literature. Eventually, Hariki says he's hungry and begins to walk downstairs before he quickly comes back and tells Yozo to follow him. As they're walking downstairs, Hariki stops by the window to Yozo's apartment and tells Yozo to look inside. And what Yozo sees, a small window opened over my room, through which I could see the interior. The light was lit and two animals were visible. My eyes swam, but I murmured to myself through my violent breathing, "This is just another aspect of the behavior of human beings. There's nothing to be surprised at." I stood petrified on the staircase, not even thinking to help Yoshiko. Hariki noisily cleared his throat. I ran back up to the roof to escape and collapsed there. I had now lost all confidence in myself, doubted all men immeasurably, and abandon all hopes for the things of this world, all joy, all sympathy, eternally. This was truly the decisive incident of my life. So, if it wasn't clear enough, Yozo watched Yoshiko be attacked by a man. But not only that, while watching it happen, he did nothing to help his wife. Instead, he simply looked at it logically as animals doing what animals do. This was violently shocking whenever I read the story, especially with the context that you all are going to have in a little bit. And it's a lot to just run up on that. What can I do to make it better? I have nothing this time. We just have to get through it, I guess. And to make the situation even more brutal, Hariki walks up to Yozo and tells Yozo he should forgive her because Yozo's not a prize himself, which... Where does this guy think that he has the authority to say anything he just said? And to make it even more depressing, after laying there in solitude, it says, "Without my realizing it, Yoshiko was standing helplessly behind me. He told me he wouldn't do anything. It's all right. Don't say anything. You didn't know enough to distrust others." Yoshiko, as we've established, is far too good for Yozo, and Yozo is only with her just to see how it goes. Yozo remarks at how furious he is at Hariki, that Hariki saw this happening and then took the time to go upstairs and get Yozo, and then bring him down there and quietly show him. However, Yozo also didn't do anything whenever he found out what was going on. There's a sense of hypocrisy with a lot of what Yozo says throughout the story, not only in the situation we just saw where he got mad at Hariki for doing the same things that he did, but the reason he's afraid of humans is because he's afraid that humanity and personality is just a mask for the deeper machinations and concepts of whatever a people is. But as we know, Yozo's entire personality is a mask for the deeper people and imaginations that he has. And in the following passages, he barely cares about what happened to Yoshiko. The only thing he does care about is that he feels this experiment of his, or this case study in trust, has been broken. And while he sees that as being a mishap or a tragedy of sorts, it's not like there's any connection that's been broken. It essentially just means that he's lost interest in her. One night, whenever he comes home, he finds that Yoshiko has bought several sleeping pills, so he decides to take all of them at once. He survives this, and whenever he wakes up, he's surrounded by the woman from the bar, Hariki, and Flatfish. Yoshiko feels like Yozo did this because of what happened to her, which is horrifically tragic, but still Yozo doesn't care. Flatfish says that Yozo needs to get a hold of himself because it's the second time he's done this now. So Flatfish gives him some money and tells him to go to a retreat in the mountains in order to detox. Instead, Yozo takes that money and blows it on alcohol and goes on another bender. On his way back from this bender, he begins to cough up blood and thinks that that's probably not good. So he goes to see a pharmacist in town, and upon meeting the pharmacist, he recognizes the same sadness in her that's in himself. And for the first time since Tsuneko, the woman who jumped in the ocean, he feels a kindred spirit. So he explains to the woman that he's been drinking a lot and is now coughing up blood, and the woman said that the same thing happened to her husband before he died. So she gives him several medications in order to get over his alcoholism, and eventually gives him a syringe, telling him only to take the syringe whenever he absolutely must have a drink. This syringe is morphine. Initially, Yozo says that the morphine makes him feel great, and that whenever he takes it, it's even better than a drink, because then he can be productive and work on his mangas. But then one syringe a day becomes two, and then three, and then four, and eventually, he's at the pharmacist every other day, asking for more needles. He even begins having an affair with the pharmacist, so that she'll begin sliding him drugs. He comes into crippling debt because of the morphine, and decides that he's going to write his father a letter, and if his father doesn't reply, he's going to attempt the thing that he's already attempted twice, a third time. Sure enough, his father never replies, and he decides on a day to do it. But whenever that day arrives, Hariki and Flatfish show up, seemingly by coincidence, and tell Yozo that he needs to stay at a facility, because at this point the signs of a morphine addiction are beginning to weigh on him. So Flatfish, Hariki, and Yoshiko take Yozo to a sanitarium. As they're about to leave him there, the story says, "When Flatfish, Hariki, and Yoshiko were about to go, leaving me there alone, Yoshiko handed me a bundle containing a change of clothes, then silently offered from her handbag the hypodermic needle and the remaining medicine. Is it possible she actually believed, after all that, it was just an energy-building medicine?" Because he had lied to her and said that the medicine that he's taking is just an energy builder and supposed to make him feel better. And her still trusting him, in spite of every stupid mistake Yozo's done, Yoshiko still trusts him enough that she brought him the morphine because he said it was the medicine that makes him feel better. And for the first time, Yozo says, "No, I don't think I'll need it," which is the first time in his entire life that he's ever turned down a suggestion for anything. While at the sanitarium, Yozo says, "I had gone into the car that took me here, and now I had become a madman. Even if released, I would be forever branded on the forehead with the word madman, or perhaps reject, disqualified as a human being. I had now ceased utterly to be a human being." The title of the story, No Longer Human, is the English approximation of what the original title was trying to say, but the direct Japanese to English translation is disqualified as a human being. So here, whenever Yozo says that he is now disqualified as a human being because he's in the sanitarium, that is the title of the story, and underlines the story's thesis. He had always felt separate and apart from humanity, so now in here with the other rejects, as he calls them, he feels that he is finally branded as such. Eventually, after staying in the psych ward, Yozo's brother comes to him and says that their father has passed away. Yozo's conflicted by this because while his father was a terror in his life, it was a pain that he was comfortable with. And now that that is a part of his life removed, he doesn't know what the future holds. Again, it's that fear of the unknown that causes dread, even if dread was there to begin with. Yozo's brother, who has also taken up politics, tells Yozo that if Yozo will move into the countryside, away from people and women and bars, which is probably the best move, Yozo's brother will support him financially for the rest of his life. Yozo takes him up on this deal and moves into the countryside, where he lives with an elderly woman who acts as his caretaker. This is almost comforting because for the first time, his good looks and charm doesn't work, so him and the old woman constantly nag and bicker at each other, even remarking that the old woman began to spike him with laxatives, which is pretty funny. And then Yozo's account ends with these lines: "Now I have neither happiness nor unhappiness. Everything passes. That is the one and only thing I have thought resembled the truth in the society of human beings where I have dwelled up to now as in a burning hell. Everything passes. This year I am 27. My hair has become much grayer. Most people would take me for over 40. And then after that, we get our epilogue. The epilogue is from the same person who wrote the prologue, the one who looked at the pictures of Yozo throughout his life and thought that his uncanny non-humanity was alarming. In the epilogue, this writer explains to us that he was traveling through Japan and came across the woman who ran the bar that Yozo lived above whenever he met Yoshiko across the street. This woman knew the writer, and supposedly because he's an author, she decided to give him a series of notebooks and photos from someone who used to live above the bar. Of course, that someone being Yozo. The author remarks that he read these notebooks and felt so utterly terrified by the position of Yozo that he decided to publish them as is in their entirety. And of course, that account is the story we just read. So the man goes back to the woman who ran the bar and asks how she came across him. And she says that they simply arrived in the mail one day, most likely from Yozo, but there was no return address and she hasn't heard from him since. So the author asks her, "Did you cry?" And she says, "No, I didn't cry. I just kept thinking that when human beings get that way, they're no good for anything." The man replies, "It's been 10 years. I suppose he may be dead already. He must have sent the notebooks to you by way of thanks. Some parts are rather exaggerated, I can tell, but you obviously suffered a hell of a lot at his hands. If everything written in these notebooks is true, I probably would have wanted to put him in an insane asylum myself if I were his friend." And then the woman says, It's his father's fault, she said unemotionally. The Yozo we knew was so easygoing and amusing. And if only he hadn't drunk. No, even though he did drink, he was a good boy. An angel. And that is the ending of No Longer Human. So you're probably listening right now, if you hadn't heard of this story before, been like, wow, Wendigoon, that was really sad and depressing. But don't worry, it gets worse. So to paint the picture for how I came across the story, again, it started because I was reading Junji Ito's adaptation, which we'll talk about in just a second. But I was reading through this story, and it was bothering me, right? The concept of it. Because I knew nothing about Osamu Dazai. I knew nothing about this being an original novel, which, as a matter of fact, is the second best-selling novel in Japan of all time. So I was completely clueless to all of that. And I got near the end of this story, and I said, there is something about this that I'm missing. It's literally too depressing and sad for it to just be something. I didn't believe Junji Ito just came up with this out of nowhere, because it was too dark for him, right? Like, obviously he covers dark and brutal subject matter, but this was something else. This was inhuman, almost, right? So I got to the last chapter of Ito's book, and I stopped, and I said, okay, I have to figure out where the story is. So it says on the cover, Junji Ito, original novel by Osamu Dazai. So I decide to look up Osamu Dazai, and this is what I find. To give you some bullet notes about Osamu Dazai's life, he was born in 1909 to a very wealthy family, and his father was a politician. After attending college, he got into a rhythm of becoming drunk at bars and visiting brothels until he was eventually expelled from college for poor attendance. In 1929, he attempted to take his own life when he jumped into the ocean with a woman he met at a bar. He survived, married, and attempted once again with sleeping pills before he became a morphine addict and spent some time in a psych ward. So, as you've probably put together, at least in parts, No Longer Human is the life of the author Osamu Dazai. However, where the story between Yozu and Osamu differs is its ending. Because 1 month after the release of No Longer Human in 1948, Osamu and his mistress, named Tomie, tied themselves together and jumped into a river, ending both of their lives. And it is believed by many that No Longer Human is the final message and confession of Osamu Dazai. So, that turns the story from a collection of terrible events happening to supposedly a terrible person into something else. Now, I'm not trying to say that all of the terrible things that Yozo did and things that happened to Yozo are confessions of what happened in Osamu's life, but more so a commentary on his feelings regarding it. Like, there's no evidence in events like Yozo witnessing what was happening to Yoshiko, there's no evidence that that happened in Osamu's life. And perhaps it was just Osamu projecting an idea of how a situation like that might be, or that was just him inserting a tragedy onto this character. Furthermore, I think that Osamu's position would have to be at least slightly removed from Yozo's, because there is a lot of commentary from other characters around Yozo, and around how what he's doing is either wrong, or how he can overcome it, or what have you. It's for reasons like that I don't believe this story is a one-to-one confession. However, what I do think is a one-to-one translation is those sections of the story where Yozo thinks to himself what the greater purpose of society and people could be. So whenever you take his concepts of why he doesn't fit into humanity, and why existence itself is so terrifying, and remove it from a fictional character and apply it to a real person, it becomes so much more tragic and so much more impactful. And whenever you think about it that way, that at least to some degree, there's too many coincidences for it to be anything else, that Yozo is Osamu's self-insert, then the final lines of the story are gut-wrenching. It's his father's fault, she said unemotionally. The Yozo we knew was so easygoing and amusing, and if only he hadn't drunk. No, even though he did drink, he was a good boy. An angel. man, I go back and forth if I think that this is him saying how other people perceived him. Because as we understand, Yozo's ideas were much more terrible than just his drunkenness. If anything, his drunkenness was a shield for his realness. So I go back and forth if it's that, the people still don't understand him, or if it's some kind of final hope that maybe people would hope there to be some good in him. Either way, it's brutal, but there's this desperation to that last line that has been eating at me ever since I read it. So now you're definitely like, wow, Wendigoon, I hate you, which, join the club. And to be honest, I probably wouldn't have talked about all of that, because that is a lot to throw out there on random people who I've never met across the internet, not giving any regard to what situation they're at in life or, you know, what kind of stories they wanted to consume today. But you're welcome, I guess. But I wouldn't have talked about any of that if it wasn't for this. So Junji Ito is a horror author, as many of us know, and the majority of his stories revolve around these horrific concepts or character designs that do a lot of the work within the story. And while that may sound like a criticism, I promise it's not. Some of the concepts he's come up with are some of the most unique and brutal that I've seen in any medium. And if you read enough of Ito's stories, there's kind of a flavor to them that you get used to. There are people being confronted with some either cosmic or gory entity that is beyond the standards of humanity. And rarely does the story have any kind of hopeful turn or ending. As with most horror, it's about the lingering fear of the threat still being present. So how did an author who normally just makes stories around the supernatural and the bizarre make a story about a man's struggle with mental health, depression, and alcoholism? And the answer is, he did what he always does, made it bloody. To give you an idea of how loud Ito's interpretation is, the story opens with a depiction of Osamu Dazai's death. Not Yozo, the character, the author's death. Which, you gotta put yourself in my position, right? I sat down to read this book. No concept of No Longer Human, or of who Osamu Dazai was, or any of that. I open this story and see this death depicted, and I'm like, wow, that's pretty sad. And then I read through the story, and like I mentioned earlier, I stop near the end and decide to look up the author. And whenever I read that that is how he died, and I remembered how this book opened, I was flabbergasted. Could you imagine if that happened literally anywhere else? Imagine if a famous author or director or someone like that died. So whenever someone else adapts their work, they open it with that director dying. Like, you want to talk about throwing the hammer down as soon as you walk into a room. This would have been, I could imagine if like you read No Longer Human and you were anticipating this story's release, and that's the first thing you're greeted with. Like, after you do that, you have a lot to prove as the story goes on. But surprisingly, I think Ito pulls it off. And the way he does that is, I think Ito better understands Osamu Dazai than any other author ever could. At this point, you've seen several renditions of the artwork Ito did for scenes within the original story. And it's hard to explain unless you read it, and I'm also not recommending you read it, because the brutal stuff mentioned is fully depicted, and if you're the type of person to read it, you don't need my permission. But if you're not, don't. Do not read this book. See, where the novel told us the narrative through Yozo's perspective, Junji shows us the world visually through his perspective as well. So because of that, the monsters, gory images, and terrifying concepts that we see through most of Ito's work, in this story, those are just people. When Osamu would write about how Yozo saw the horrors of humanity and how people appear to be monstrous, and how Yoza one day wanted to be an artist to show others what that monstrosity was, it's almost like, in a symbolic way, Ito is fulfilling the wishes of Yoza by bringing these horses from hell to life. And because of that, the images that Osamu was trying to convey to us whenever he wrote Yoza as a version, at least in some part, of himself, those terrifying concepts he was telling us about, Junji does him justice by showing us them in all of his gory, horrific fashion. And Yoza adapts several of these characters so that they have more of an affecting role in the plot. For instance, Takaichi, where in the original novel, after Yoza leaves high school, he disappears from the story. In Ito's version, he is killed from a lie that Yoza tells. So because of that, for the rest of Yozo's life, he sees visions of Takaichi wherever he goes. And while you're reading the story, it seems almost supernatural. Anytime that Yoza is happy for perhaps a moment, or something close to happiness, he sees a vision of this dead childhood friend. And while you may think that the story has a supernatural element, it's just the visions that Yoza is placing over the world. These horrible rose-colored glasses of misery that he puts on everything. Yoshiko dies, the woman at the pharmacy dies, one of the sisters from the beginning of the story when he was in high school dies, like I mentioned, Takaichi dies. And you may be hearing all this and think that this Ito rendition is a little bit disrespectful. I mean, he opens it with Osamu's death, and then he features several people that we can imagine are analogies for real-life people, and then Ito kills them in various brutal fashions. So it almost gives this sense of malice or hatred for the people involved with the original story. And I kind of thought about that too, until I started to read some of the things about Osamu's life and saw how Ito adapted them, and think that Ito did exactly what he set out to do. For example, earlier in the original novel, as a matter of fact in the epilogue, it's mentioned that Yoza is as if a human's head was removed and a horse's head was attached to it. And later when talking to Takaichi, you'll remember that Yoza makes the analogy of a horse from hell as this ghost of people. So in Ito's version, the horse from hell is a self-portrait that Yoza draws in high school, which feels like a very fitting mixture of the concepts brought up in the story. Both the author referred to Yoza being a horse-human thing, and Yoza himself brought up the concept of a horse from hell, so it seems like a natural merger. Yoza attempts to paint several more portraits throughout the story, which again link into this idea of Yozo's inner turmoil and how he sees the world, and of course the depictions within the manga itself are depictions of how Yoza sees the world. Another detail is that in Ito's adaptation, Yozo's paintings serve a greater purpose. For example, later in the story, Yoza makes a second portrait, this time one of his wife, Yoshiko. Of course, her appearance in this painting is ghastly and horrific, because this is how Yoza sees the ghost of humanity. So as the story progresses and Yozo's actions continue to hurt Yoshiko, her physical form begins to more resemble her ghost than the beautiful woman we once knew. Just as how by the end of the story, Yoza resembles his self-portrait of a horse from hell. While you may attribute some prophetic nature to Yoza because of this, it seems that these ghosts he were afraid of is what these people eventually become. It was Yozo's actions that turned himself and his wife into ghosts. And because of that, Yoza ended up creating the monster that he was always afraid of. But one of the scenes that really did it for me is when Yoza almost dies. If you'll remember in the novel, there was a section while he was married to Yoshiko where he takes a bunch of sleeping pills and then survives and he wakes up and Flatfish and Hariko are there and blah blah blah. Well, in Ito's version, that is a much longer scene where, while in this coma state of mind, Yoza begins to deal with his past traumas. There is a line mentioned in the beginning of the novel. Well, I can pull it up, hold on. When describing his childhood, Yoza says, "I have sometimes thought that I have been burdened with a pack of 10 misfortunes, any one of which, if borne by my neighbor, would be enough to make a murderer of him." Speaking of the vices and tragedies that he experiences in his life. Well, during the scene whenever Yoza slips into a coma in Ito's manga rendition, he encounters these 10 misfortunes. Among these misfortunes are things like his father, his clowning, pressure from adults, other tragedies that he experienced. But then at the end of these 10 misfortunes, just whenever Yozo is about to die, he has the vision of a woman named Toki. In real life, Osamu Dazai was raised by a wet nurse named Takai. Takai raised Osamu and taught him principles of life, of right and wrong, and other things that a mother would normally teach a child. Osamu would once remark that I am Takai's child. So here, Junji Ito adds a character to Yozo's journey who is someone that was a powerful influence in Osamu's journey. So as Yozo was Osamu's stand-in for himself, to see Ito literally bring Yozo out of hell with the memories of his mother is such a beautiful portrayal. But what has to be the most powerful scene in this entire adaptation is the scene at the sanitarium, and honestly the reason I felt compelled to make this video. See, in the novel, the sanitarium was briefly mentioned. We get our name drop of no longer human or disqualified as a human being, and that's it. But as we know, Osamu, in real life, stayed at a sanitarium to recover from his morphine addiction. And in this story, Yozo stays at a sanitarium to recover from his morphine addiction. So instead of having the two be one character, as it can kind of be assumed in the original, Junji Ito makes them two people who meet each other. One night, Yozo sees a stranger begging for morphine before the stranger turns his face and realizes that the two look just alike. And then one night, whenever Yozo is experiencing withdrawals and having visions of the people that he's hurt and hurt him throughout his life, Yozo comes to this stranger and collapses at his feet, telling him everything. And the stranger is taken back, because as he says later, this is his life as well. It's a little nebulous, kind of cosmic, you know, the author meeting the self-insert, but I'll allow it, I think it works. The man introduces himself to Yozo as Osamu Dazai. And while talking, the two are both broken kindred spirits. In one scene, after Yozo finds out that his father has passed away, he goes to Osamu and tells him this. And Osamu says, I also lost my father when I was 14. I understand how you feel so well, I can almost taste it. Congratulations, you're free now. And Yozo says, I don't know why, but the tears streamed unceasingly down my cheeks. The life of both Osamu and Yozo within the story is so brutal and kind of exists as this bitter point in history. It's just this tragic situation defined by nothing but grief. So here in this asylum, between the two of each other, by almost confessing themselves of the same sins, there's this hint of reprieve and a nice spot in history for both the character and the author. There's an underlining of that confession whenever Yozo reads the stories that Osamu's been writing. And after Yozo asks, are these your own experiences? Just like Yozo always does, Osamu puts on a face and he says, what? Who's to say? That view of things makes light of human creativity, perhaps. It's mostly fiction. And Yozo, knowing exactly where he's coming from, says, I see. Dazai, you're rather easily carried away too. For both of us. It's hard to keep acting out our comedy. Yozo was always so scared of someone looking through his mask and seeing him. But now, two people wearing masks are able to see each other. And then as they continue, Yozo looks at Osamu and says, at any rate, Dazai, I was overwhelmed by this book. I'm certain you'll become a great writer and go down in history. Osamu was successful through his life, but he wouldn't know the height of popularity or this insane legacy he would create. And there's something to be said that's a greater topic for a video when I'm less tired and not however many hours we are into this. But there's something to be said about the legacy of a character that is created and represents real human emotions and ideas, but yet isn't, you know, a real human. However, there's still this sacred nature to creating something that looks and acts like a human but isn't one. And for Ito to have Osamu's own creation assure him that he would one day be a great writer. Again, it's a beautiful moment in all the ugly. So when Yozo leaves the sanitarium, he says goodbye to Osamu, who says that he will make Yozo's life into a story. And it's the very ending of Ito's rendition that's perhaps the most profound. To properly explain it, I need to give a little bit of setup, a difference between Ito's version and Osamu Dazai's original novel. In the novel, there is the cousin who is briefly mentioned at the beginning of the story. If you'll remember, there's two cousins. One of them threw herself onto him and said that she wants to run away, and Yozo just kind of like shrugged it off. In Ito's version, Yozo got one of the cousins pregnant, and she got into a fight with the other cousin and ended up killing her. So for that, the cousin that he got pregnant was sent to an insane asylum. And after the child was born, Yozo was terrified as it looked just like Takaichi. Now remember, Ito's version is not strictly within the realms of reality. It exists as Yozo's portrayal of what the world is. So it's not that the child is literally the spitting image of the young friend he ended up killing. It's just that that's how Yozo sees it, because his guilt weighs him down. So whenever Yozo is staying at the sanitarium at the end of the story when he meets Osamu, it turns out that that cousin who he had the child with is there with the child. Initially, Yozo just starts seeing these visions of Takaichi and assumes that it's some ghost or apparition he's seen, but then he figures out it's his child with the cousin who got thrown into an asylum. I'm sure that sounds really weird and convoluted, and while it is a little bit, it makes more sense in the story, just trust me. So in Ito's version, whenever Yozo goes to live in the country after he leaves the sanitarium, he takes the cousin and his child with him. So Ito's story ends with Osamu Dazai going out to the countryside to meet his old friend he met in the sanitarium. And whenever Osamu gets there, he finds that Yozo is living in horrific conditions. A rundown house with an old housekeeper that hates him, which again lines up with the ending of the novel. However, in Ito's version, Yozo is also living with the child that looks like the friend he caused the death of, and a wife, I guess you could call it wife, cousin wife, who absolutely hates him and begins to yell and beat him while Osamu is there. And forever, this version of Yozo has to exist with both the memory of the sin he committed to his cousin and the offspring of that sin that is the spitting image of the sin he committed against a friend that led to his death. Which is a horrific purgatory for this fictional character. And the story ends with Yozo on a beach as he watches the wife who hates him and the son who terrifies him fly a kite. On the kite is a newspaper. The newspaper reporting on the death of the author, Osamu Dazai. And as he continues to sit there in this miserable condition, the story ends on the lines, "Now I have neither happiness nor unhappiness. Everything passes." There is something so somber to this ending. Because, as I talked about before, where the novel and real life end are both in a place of tragedy. It is a horrific end for Yozo and Osamu in a way that can never really be resolved. And it looks like throughout a lot of Ito's adaptation, he is kind of resolving that. There's the scene as he's in a coma where Yozo talks to the wet nurse that raised him, and that allows him to overcome these tragedies that he's facing. And near the end of the story, there is again a sweet moment whenever he speaks to Osamu directly. But here at the end, it's almost ripped away from us in this tragic fashion. Because in this narrative that Ito has crafted, Osamu is gone. As we saw at the beginning of the story, the opening pages of this story, he was gone as soon as it started. And despite that, and despite the reminder of it at the end with the kite, Yozo is still on that beach. Yes, there was tragedy, and yes, there were moments of peace, but in spite of all of it, what Osamu did didn't fix it. And it's bizarre, but it's almost as if Ito is saying that yes, there is a peace, and yes, there is a finality to it, almost witnessed with the final shot of the manga, which is Yozo decrepit and broken, sure, but smiling while in his chair. But despite those moments, the tragedy was not bested by another tragedy. Yozo will still be on that beach in this perpetual state of existence for time to come. And it's a matter of fact, brutal, depressing way, but I think it is the best way to handle this story. And it's from that place of respect that I think Ito had the right heart going into this story. And to portray such a brutal depiction in a way that both does justice to it, brings the author's original goals to fruition through visual elements, but also provides him a sense of peace. I don't think he could have done it any better, or perhaps any more terrible. And I mean that in the best way. And that's why I thought it was worth talking about. And if this has made your life substantially worse, as it probably has mine, for one, I warned you in the beginning. But I hope you maybe got something out of all of this sadness. And yeah, me too. But regardless of how you feel, I feel pretty great. Because you stuck around this long to watch my video, and that means a lot to me. And I just want to say thank you for watching. This story is a lot. It's very sad. And to be honest, I'm so glad that I get to quit talking about it now. I read Ito's version like 2 weeks ago, and like in the span of a couple days, read it and then, you know, read about his life and everything. And I have just been kind of contemplating how to word it. I don't write scripts, for those that don't know. I write like quick bullet notes and then talk off of those. And I've been trying to postulate how to talk about all this grief and misery. And hopefully this came out at least semi-coherent. But now I don't have to talk about it anymore, so I'm feeling pretty great. And I got to trauma dump all of that onto you all, and it is off my hands. Unless this video gets age-restricted and demonetized, in which case I'm literally talking to a mirror. But for real, thank you all for watching. I'm glad you all stuck around. Thank you all for being here. It's the spooky season. Isn't this fun and creepy? Yay! I have other Halloween videos that are coming out. I didn't intend for this to be the first one, but here we are. There'll be some cryptid stuff in here somewhere. I'll make it up to you, I promise. Thank you all for sticking around this long. Now that I got all of that out of the way, for those who are still here and still sticking around, I have a Halloween product limited time offer. This is all you get to see of it now. My logo on the side. And that's it. There will be more information in the future to come. Don't tell the people who didn't stick around. Shh, this is just for us for now. But I'll talk about that sooner to come. October 25th. Mark it in your calendar. But thank you all so much for being here. Thank you all for the support that you've continued to show me. It means the most. We're at 1.88 million, I think, which again is a number I can't really comprehend, so I'm just going to choose to not to. But for real, thank you all for getting me here. So yeah, there are new Halloween videos on the way. Have some cool projects with some other YouTubers. I've been thankful. I've been in a blessed enough opportunity to be on a lot of YouTubers' channels and a lot of people I respect lately, and I really appreciate that, the support. If I work with someone, they're good people to me. And it means a lot to see you all share that support. So thank you. But yeah, I believe that should do it for now. New videos on the way. But for now, I just want to say thank you for watching. I hope that you enjoyed. And I will see you in the next one.